Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nuchtigall, your host. Got a fascinating interview with you today of some new research that was done on the Siloam inscription. This is the 2,700-year-old inscription that was carved into the bedrock on the wall of the Siloam Tunnel, on what is more commonly known as Hezekiah's Tunnel, named after, of course, King Hezekiah, which was constructed around the time of the incursion by Sennacherib, the Assyrian king's army, into Judah. I'm going to talk with Professor Ariel Cohen. He is the Associate Professor of Linguistics at the Department of Foreign Literatures and Linguistics at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev there in Beersheba. He presented this research publicly a short time ago, and then he has written that up for Biblical Archaeology Review, and then he's going to be coming out with a scientific paper later on. If you like the content, don't forget to like and subscribe to our channel. We also produce a free magazine on biblical archaeology that comes out 6 times per year. It's 40 pages, full color. If you'd like to receive that magazine, go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, and you'll see a place on the front page to request your free subscription. Or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org. Simply put your name and address, and we can sign you up for your own free subscription to our magazine on biblical archaeology, also called Let the Stone Speak. But now, here's the interview. Professor Ariel Cohen, thanks very much for coming on Let the Stone Speak.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
So this is a really interesting article you have here in Biblical Archaeology Review. I understand you have another publication coming out, but this is what we have so far. So this would be a great basis for our discussion today about an inscription that is probably one of the most well-known inscriptions in biblical period Israel and Judah, the Siloam inscription. Perhaps as we get into this, you can give a just a brief history of where this is found and the timing of its discovery, perhaps, and then the inscription itself.
Right. So this was found inside the Siloam Tunnel, which is a tunnel that brings water from the Gihon Spring in Jerusalem to a pool, the Siloam Pool. And it was built in, most people think it was built in the time of Hezekiah, in anticipation of the Assyrian invasion by Sennacherib of 701. Some people put it a little earlier, a little later, but everybody agrees it's well established. This is from the First Temple period. And it's a really magnificent piece of engineering because it was dug by two groups of workers, one from each end, and they were digging towards each other, and they needed to be able to find each other down there in the rock, which, you know, if they hadn't done this, the whole project would have failed. And to this day, we're not quite sure how they did it.
Yeah.
So this is the tunnel.
And I would just mention, if people haven't been through it, this is something that visitors to Jerusalem can do in the City of David Tourist Park. You can go down and walk through Hezekiah's Tunnel, 1,700 feet around that, just over 500 meters, I think, 550 meters. So on a hot day, it is refreshing. And on a cool day, it's actually slightly warmer down there than it is up on the surface of Jerusalem in the winter. So you can do it year round. So if people are really interested in this, you can go and see this and experience the tunnel itself yourself.
Right. And you can see a replica of the inscription in the tunnel itself. The actual inscription is in Istanbul. And so it was discovered in the late 19th century. A kid was wading in the tunnel, was filled with water and muck, actually, at the time. And he slid and he fell. And when he got up, he noticed this inscription. Mm-hmm. And later it was an attempt to take it out. They didn't do a very good job. They broke it into several pieces. And then the Ottoman authorities took over and brought it to Istanbul,
Where it is to this day.
where it is to this day. So it was found inside the tunnel, close to the other end, to the pool, but definitely inside the tunnel.
So if people go through the tunnel, they can see the portion. I guess it's probably about 10 meters, something like that, before you exit the tunnel, ballpark from memory. And they'll see on your left, about head height, it's a big gouge is taken out of the bedrock itself. So it's an inscription that's carved into the bedrock wall of the tunnel. You can see, I think it's three holes from memory that are behind it, where I guess they used some technology to try and get it, rip it out of the wall or take part of the stone with them. But you can see the indentation that is there, and then the replica should be, I think, just after it. You might actually see the replica, but you might miss this if you're not looking for it and thinking about it as you're walking through the tunnel.
Right. It's what because I mean, it is dark there,
Yeah.
which is really, really part of the puzzle.
Yeah,
That
so
is.
this is what's so fascinating about your theory that you're talking about, that you've written about, is for people that have gone through Hezekiah's tunnel, they recognize, they know the story that it was built from both sides. If they're looking for it, they can find the meeting point of the two teams that is closer to the actual the earlier the front of it, or the entrance, or it's closer to the entrance, is it? And then the inscription, if they know this inscription, they might look there, but it's not even there. It's way down the other side. So perhaps you can get into some of why you think, or who you think the inscription was for, or how the inscription was written first. However you want to tackle this, I think would be best.
Right, I mean that's really the puzzle, isn't it? It's not where you would expect it to be, and it's not doesn't say what you'd expect it to say. So it's well, it's written in Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, and written in the Paleo Hebrew, the old Hebrew font, and you can really pretty clearly, all the a lot of it is intact. Some words are missing, but most of them can be reconstructed with fair certainty.
Do we have the top and the bottom of, like, is it the complete inscription that we have, or is a part of it missing from before or after, or is it the entire thing?
Well, there is no, nothing at the top. Some people have conjecture that maybe there was some more stuff written before.
Okay.
It's a conjecture. I
But
mean,
it
there's
looks like a
no
complete
indication.
inscription.
Right. I mean, what is clearly missing is the first word.
Okay.
First word is missing. And then there is what looks like a title. And I think we will look at the text in a moment. We can talk about that. But that's what we have. We don't have what maybe, possibly, could have been more. We don't know. We know what we have in our hands.
Okay.
So we know it was not graffiti. It was not somebody just, walking down the tunnel and scratching "Kilroy was here," this sort of thing. It's an inscription that is professionally done. Somebody who was skilled in carving carved it. I suppose got paid pretty handsomely for it. Somebody took a lot of effort and thought and money, I guess, in order to make this inscription. And it's clearly talking about the tunnel.
Right.
So you'd think there is an inscription, a monumental inscription about the tunnel. It must be used to commemorate this really impressive engineering feat, saying, look, what I, King Hezekiah, or whoever did this, look what I've done. But the thing is that If you want to write an inscription like that, you want to commemorate your accomplishments, you want people to see it, you want people to read it, you want people to marvel at it. And you put it inside the tunnel in the dark where nobody can see it. You have to go there with a torch. And I assume also you wouldn't be able to go there because, you know, this was the type, the lifeline of the city. This
There's not
was,
too many people that are going to be allowed into this water tunnel.
right. I'm sure it was heavily guarded. I suppose every once in a while, you know, a worker would come in to maintain it, clean it, this sort of thing. You don't write this sort of inscription, put so much effort and money and time into it for this guy with a, you know, with a shovel who's cleaning the tunnel. So that's a puzzle that everybody who writes about this inscription acknowledges. And people say, look, this is really strange. This, why did they put the inscription down there in the tunnel? We don't know. And
One
then they
thing
go to
I
the
would
tunnel.
just add, just before you get into discussing the inscription, is just how rare, just for people that are uninitiated. Finding an inscription is what you'd like to do in archaeology, is because it tells you from the people that are there, information that you can't get from just the stones and the rocks themselves or the pottery. And in terms of Jerusalem, monumental inscriptions like this don't really exist. There's a couple of fragments of large inscriptions that have been found, but this is the most complete, massive, or at least with the words that are used and the letters that are used, inscription, if I'm not mistaken, that's ever been found, probably in Judah, itself, this inscription. So it's a big deal. It's not just a random, a small inscription, because we don't have any others like this. It's a big inscription.
Right, absolutely. And you'd expect if you did find an ornamental inscription, it would be something like, I, King such and such, did this and did that. We find things like this all over the ancient Near East, right? But yeah, in Judah, it's an outlier by all accounts.
All right, so let's get into what you think about what it says, first of all, I suppose.
So there's this text, and it's my translation, but other translations are comparable. And square brackets indicate stuff that is reconstructed. So there is the first word. Nobody knows what it was, so I will not try to guess here. And then what looks like a title, this the Hebrew word nekivah or nikbah, which indicates cutting or drilling a hole through something, so call it the cutting through. That seems to be the title. And then it says, and this was the account of the cutting through. While the stone cutters were swinging the axe one towards the other, and while there were still 3 cubits to be cut through, there was heard the sound of one calling to the other, for there was a zeda. We don't know what this word means. We will hopefully get to it. There was a zeda in the rock on the right and on the left. And on the day of the cutting through, the stone cutters were hewing each towards the other, axe upon axe. And the water flowed from the outlet to the pool for 1,200 cubits, and 100 cubits was the height of the rock over the heads of the stone cutters.
Magnificent.
Right. It is been a beautiful language, and it is, like I said, pretty clear, except for this word Zeta, which we'll hopefully talk about. It seems to be pretty clear. And also, again, it seems to be pretty strange because it doesn't tell you what you would expect from a commemorative inscription. You know, we in this such and such a year, there was this situation, the Assyrians are coming or whatever. And we had to build this tunnel, and we did this, and we did that. It throws you directly into the middle of the action of the event.
So there's no external context that would add the details for the uninitiated.
Exactly. So there's something strange about this. And if you think about it as a commemorative inscription, it's an inscription that says, look at what we did here. And like I said, most people say, well, it is strange, but it is what it is. It is a unique example. and they go on to discuss other things. But I think it's a puzzle that needs to be addressed. And the key, I think, to addressing is to try to figure out who wrote it and for whom. Who was the author and who was the intended addressee? If we know who wrote it to whom, maybe we'll figure out what it meant, what is its purpose, why was it written, and why was it put in the tunnel in the dark.
Okay,
So it
so
doesn't sit.
let's break it down then. What do you think? Because it's only inside this tunnel and not on the exterior, if that's the way you'd like to approach it.
So it doesn't say, right? The inscription doesn't say, I, X, writing to you, Y, I'm going to tell you such and such. But there are clues. If you look at the text, it seems to be very evocative, very, very direct. It looks like an eyewitness account, like somebody who actually witnessed these events and also knows all sorts of details, knows about the tools that were used, the axes, knows about measurements, how long it was, how deep it was. So it's pretty widely agreed upon that the authors are the workers themselves, the
Okay.
people who actually dug the tunnel.
So you're saying that
They're
the
the
workers
ones.
could write this, or they got a scribe to do it for them, or it
Right. I don't know if they could read and write themselves. Maybe they couldn't even compose a beautiful language, and I don't think they were able to carve the letters so well into the wall, so they probably paid somebody to do it for them.
Okay.
But the idea, the words, the content is theirs.
Okay.
They are the ones who decided they wanted to express something. We'll talk about what it is they wanted to express, and they probably got somebody to carve it for them. So again, they invested in this. I don't expect they were very rich people, and I suppose something like this would cost money and needed to be arranged, but it was important to them, so they did this.
Okay.
What is less clear is who they wrote it for.
Right.
Now, there is a sort of very attractive romantic notion that, they're writing it for us, for modern people here in Israel. They're sending us a message from 2,700 years ago, telling us, look, we were here and we did this and we did that and we encountered these, this crisis with the Assyrians, whatever. And they're sending us a message. And it's very appealing to think that way, but is there really any evidence for this in the text? And this is where, like you said, I'm basically a linguist. I'm not an archaeologist. I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm a linguist. I work on the meaning and the logical properties of language. And it seems to me that when people interpret ancient texts, biblical texts, or inscriptions like this, they use a variety of methods and techniques and theories. But there is one available out there, science, that they can use, they ought to use, and they don't really use it very often. And that's linguistics. Linguistics is a science. And linguistics, by the way, is a science. It's in a sense kind of like archaeology, where you have a right or wrong answer. You look at a piece of pottery. Is it 7th century or is it 8th century? There's only one correct answer. So similarly with linguistics, it really is a science. It has discoveries. It has identified rules and principles and theories about the use of language that I think can be very useful when you try to interpret text, because text is written in language, and
Right.
linguistics is a science of language. So in this case, there is a field of linguistics called discourse analysis,
Okay.
which is the analysis of interaction of dialogues or interaction of more than two people. And like I said, it has identified rules and principles we all obey. We don't obey them not because somebody told us to, and we're not usually aware of them, but we obey them because that's the way conversation behaves. So one of the most basic principles is that when you speak to somebody, you tell them stuff that they don't already know and that they're interested in knowing, that they want to know. And this I think is makes sense. It's common sense, but it also has been established in psychological experiments. And we know that these rules are obeyed because when they're broken, we feel something is not right. When somebody tells you something you already know, you say, don't tell me this, I already know it. When they tell you something you don't care about, you can be polite, but normally you would say, why are they telling me this? I'm not interested. So if we apply this, now, of course, the inscription is not a dialogue, but it is addressed to somebody. If we apply this rule to the text of this inscription, then we ask ourselves what the intended addressee, what do they know, what do they not know, and what do they want to know, right? So it's clear they know the background. They know when this tunnel was dug, what was it dug for, who commissioned it. They know all this stuff because they're not told this. They don't know how it ended. They're told how it ended, how it was completed, and they're very interested in this, and they're interested in this to a large level to a high level of detail. They want to know about the measurements and the tools. They really want to know the details. So we're looking for somebody who knows how the work started and why and all the background, doesn't know how it ended, wants to know this, and also is able somehow to read this inscription in the dark, in the middle of, not the middle, but inside the tunnel where nobody can go. Right? So that's really the puzzle. And when I put it like this, there is one solution, one answer to this that sort of suggests itself. And I think the answer is workers, friends and colleagues of those who wrote the inscription, who started working on the tunnel, and then some accident happened and they died there. And so they knew how it started, they don't know how it ended, and they are believed by the authors to have some sort of supernatural existence in the tunnel where they're able to be there and read the inscription.
So this is interesting. I think you this whole idea of a workplace accident or a problem during construction, when you look at the inscription itself, I thought this was pretty interesting. Your this elusive word that has troubled people for some time in the inscription, what it means and how it could imply more of this accidental death or something that happened inside the tunnel.
Right. So first let's try to consider what such an accident might have been like. And there is a plausible scenario because people who worked on the tunnel, they worked, I mean, studied it, modern researchers, they noticed that you couldn't let the water flow into the tunnel while you're digging it, right? Because, it'll be very difficult and dangerous. So you need to block the water of the Gihon while you're digging the tunnel, and then
Upstream.
you, yeah, the funnel where the water comes out, and once you're done, you break this wall, and the water can flow in. But it has to be blocked while you're working. Now, something like this, we can imagine that this kind of wall could break prematurely, and the water would flow into the tunnel, and that would be, very bad. You can drown, or they can hit you, can hit your head on the wall, and all sorts of unpleasantness will occur. So this could have been the accident. Now, this doesn't show that this is really what happened, but like you mentioned, if you look at this word Zeta, I think it gave us a very crucial clue, because it's a word that doesn't appear in the Bible. So people say, well, we don't know what it means. And everybody uses their own theory to say, well, Zeta means this theory. So for a long time, for example, there was a theory that people dug the tunnel from both ends They were following a crack, a fissure in the rock, and they were following this, and this is how they were able to meet each other. Well, this so then people said Zeta means a
There was
fissure.
literally somebody in my office 45 minutes ago, and I was discussing I was going to have this interview, and this is the question, this is the theory that they brought up.
Right. It was very well accepted. More recently, people actually did a very thorough study. They looked for this crack, and they found nothing there. There is no such fissure. And there's also a linguistic problem because Zeta does not seem to be related in any way to words that mean something like this.
Okay.
Now, the word itself is unique, but biblical Hebrew, like other Semitic languages, is based on roots. On three or sometimes two consonants that are inflected in a variety of ways. And the root, Z, Z and D, Zayin and Daled, the root is well attested. In fact, we know exactly what it means. So it has a literal meaning of something overflowing, something boiling. So, for example, when Jacob makes a stew that eventually Esau buys from him with the right of the firstborn. It is said that he is this word is used to describe the boiling of the stew.
Okay.
And metaphorically, it also means to go to cross boundaries, and it is used to describe bad, evil people. They're Zed,
Okay.
and we see this happening a lot in the Bible. And interestingly, the only place where something in non-human is described as Zed is a description of water, where there is a verse that says that the Zed water flowed over us, we almost died. And I think in this case it could mean overflowing water, it could mean bad, evil, menacing water. It probably means both. It's probably this ambiguity is intentional. So if we take this seriously, then this Zeta really describes a very similar situation, an overflowing water that is menacing, that is bad, that is dangerous, and eventually with bad consequences, it leads to the death of these people. So I think if this is really what happened, then the people who died in the accident literally didn't know what hit them. It would happen too quick. They heard somebody yelling, and that was it. So the inscription is, in a sense, used to tell them, look, this is what happened, and then tell them about the completion of the tunnel.
It is interesting. I'm just trying to think of the logistics here, of the timeline for this, considering I guess we don't really know where the accident took place. We could assume it happened at the meeting point. I don't know what you think about that, or close to that, before it was water was flowing through. But then when you walk through the tunnel, we see that the last, I guess, last 20% of it, something, the ceiling of the tunnel rises so much. And it's indicative that the original tunneling from the southern side, the southwestern side, began really high. And then at some point they had to lower the southern end so that the water would flow all the way out. And then the inscription is not written on the top portion where the workers would have been first, but it's written all the way down at the floor level, or when the water flows. So this implies it was written, as you say, at the completion, which is intrinsic into the inscription as well, but it could have been a certain time delay from the period in which these people died. I don't know if you have thoughts. I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know where the accident took place. I don't think there's reason to think it happened at the place of this of where we find the inscription, because if it was meant to commemorate the accident, like you have sometimes by the side of the road, you have some signs that say that there was an accident and our beloved ex died here, so. Then, of course, it would only make sense to put it in the place where the accident actually happened. But if it was as I think, it was a message to these ghosts, spirits, whatever you want to call them, then it didn't have to happen to be at the place of the accident. In fact, I think it was probably close to the entrance for the ease of the stone carver. You know, he needs to go in and bring all his tools with him. They probably didn't want to go all the way, you know, 200 meters or whatever into the middle of the tunnel to do this thing.
I just related to this. I'm just thinking about this now. I did a 3D scan. I wanted to do, we were going to do an exhibit of Hezekiah and Isaiah here, and we wanted to recreate a portion of the tunnel. And so we got permission to go on the inside of the tunnel and do a 3D scan of the, so we could get the exact grain of the wall and the height and everything of exactly what it looked like, so we could that we could do a 3 or 4 meter section of it. And I basically took went as far in as I literally had to go to where it was the right height that I could get it done. It would have been better to be somewhere else in the tunnel, but no, I went as close as I could to the entrance because I got all the stuff I've got to lug in, and it would be easier to do it there. So I guess in some ways it's what you're saying, but anciently.
Right, so I think that the location is just was just for convenience. It was important for it to be inside the tunnel, so these spirits were there would be able to see it, but it didn't have to be where the accident was, and it also it was not where the meeting point was, which we have a pretty good idea of where it was. You can see the marking of the carving on the wall, the stone cutting and where it changes direction. You can even see how they kind of, when they're close to each other, they're sort of digging in a zigzag fashion. They try to find each other until they eventually do, and that's not at all where the inscription is, which is part of I mean, okay, this is what I say about this section. Now, the common wisdom, common idea is that this describes the meeting point. This describes the event when very dramatic event when they're not sure if they're going to succeed or not, and then suddenly one team hears the other team coming towards them, and they know that they're going to be successful, and they rejoice. They're very happy. But the section doesn't actually say that. It doesn't say that this is when they first hear each other and they meet. It only says that there is a distance of 3 cubits, about 4 or 5 feet between them. And then you hear somebody crying out, and then there is this letter. And I think it's not really very likely that it indicates the event of the meeting. One reason is like we said, that it's in the wrong place for that. Right. And another reason is that 3 cubits, 4 or 5 feet, is too close for it to be the first time they hear each other. People actually did studies of how far sound travels in this kind of rock. And they're talking about 12, 15 meters, I guess at least 35 feet. So it's highly unlikely that 3 cubits, 4 or 5 feet, was the first time they heard each other. They must have heard each other long before.
Yeah, it's like the people in the north of Israel a couple of years ago complaining about they could hear digging
Oh,
underneath
yeah.
their homes, and that wasn't a couple of feet. This was they were down, 10 meters below, but they could still like faintly hear, the sound of digging traveling through the rock. That's a really good point. I haven't considered what you're saying.
Yeah, I haven't thought about this comparison, but yeah, you're right. And people actually did studies on in the area of the Siloam Tunnel itself, because one of the theories, in fact, the very widely held theory today, is that they knew how to meet each other because people on top were banging on the rock and directing them this way into where they're supposed to do to go. And this was, you know, it says here the depth was 100 cubits, so a significant distance. And also, if you look at the language, The language is, I mean, there's very strong emotion, but it's not clear at all that it's an emotion of joy, of
Yep.
triumph.
Right.
So, for example, where it says there were still 3 cubits to be cut through. This expression, we see this in the Bible, but it describes not good things but bad events. So Jacob, for example, he says, we only had a very oh, there was only a little road to get to a place called Ephrat, and then my wife Rachel died. So
Right.
we were almost there, and then she died.
Okay.
So it
Like you
actually, in a
almost
way,
made it
could
kind of thing. Almost to the conclusion.
be right. And I mean, if they had finished these 3 cubits, then maybe the accident wouldn't be so bad because the water would have an outlet, and they wouldn't die. One more thing I want to comment, if I may,
Sure.
is about this claim that the stonecutters really believed that their friends were still somehow not alive, but somehow existing in the tunnel. So this is cuts directly into beliefs that people in Iron Age Judah in those times believed about. What did they think about the afterlife? And of course, it's a very deep, a very difficult question. We have the Bible. The Bible is not always consistent on that. In many places, it says, it's a very bad thing to communicate with the dead or summon the ghosts of dead people. But from that, you understand that there were people who did this. And of
Right.
course, there is a story of the witch from Endor. She summons the spirit of Samuel, so King Saul can consult with him. But we get more a clearer indication, I think, from archaeology. And that's the practice of what is called secondary mortuary. So when somebody died, you bury them in a temporary grave.
Right.
And you wait for a while until, the flesh decomposes, and then you pick the bones and you put them in a permanent grave. And people who study this, I mean, this is a practice that was going on in various cultures, various periods, various places in the world. And usually this is associated with the idea that the dead are not completely gone. They're still around. They're still moving around. They're usually not in good shape. They're bewildered. They don't know exactly what happened to them. They can be dangerous, and there are all sorts of rituals to appease them. So this might be an indication that this was a common belief in the time that, at least for a while, the dead are still sort of moving around, and they need to be comforted. And I think this is what these stonecutters believed over their friends, and they went to all this trouble to try to tell them, look, this is what happened to you. You died in an accident, but in a sense, to tell them, your death was not in vain.
Right.
We succeeded. The project that was so important to all of us was successful. You can rest assured that you can find some rest, some solace in this knowledge.
Right. Yeah, very interesting. Certainly a fresh, definitely a fresh look. And this is kind of what I like and what I miss from archaeology. It used to be that you had people descending upon the archaeologists in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. They were disciplinarians. They brought all the tools to bear from all the different fields of science, and they were able to come up with solutions and ideas that were very outside the box. And nowadays, everyone's kind of boxed into their own way of viewing everything. An archaeologist will view archaeologists, and a person that studies inscriptions will view it inscriptions separate from the archaeological context often. And here, you're a linguist approaching it from a linguistic perspective. And that's bringing a fresh understanding, a fresh take on this inscription. Have you some of your colleagues, after thinking about your research or presenting your research, what's been the feedback like from your proposal?
So I presented this at meeting of the SBL, Society for Biblical Literature,
Okay.
and this is actually what was invited to write the article for Bar for Biblical Archaeology Review for as a consequence of this meeting,
Okay.
and people were interested. But they were still skeptical,
Of
and
course.
I had some discussions with archaeologists, and they said, and basically the idea was, so it's not so much of a puzzle. They put it inside this tunnel, hidden from view. Things like this have been known to happen, and in a sense, it's true. Because we know that in the ancient Near East, there are things called the foundation deposits,
Right.
where a king who builds a palace or a temple, they put in the foundations of the building, they put an inscription,
Right.
and it tells about his accomplishments, about the building, and it really cannot be seen by normal people.
Right.
But these inscriptions, they are either addressed to a god or to a future king. Either they say, God such and such, build this wonderful temple for you in your honor, please bless me, this sort of thing. Or they say they address it to future king and say, look, if you read this, it means this palace that I built is ruined. So please, rebuild it. I did this to the previous king before me. So please do this for me. And it's very different from this text. Again, if you apply these rules of conversation, so if this was addressed to God, God obviously knows the background, but also knows how the work was completed. So you don't need to tell him that. And we normally don't appeal to God and give him precise measurements and things like that. On the other hand, there are things God does want to hear from him, presumably, that you were a good person, that you did all sorts of these things according to his laws and this sort of thing. And this is completely absent from the inscription. And if it were meant, like again, like this romantic notion that it's meant for the future generations, you would expect it to give us this information that we don't have, the background. We don't know about the background of the tunnel from the
Right.
inscription. We know it from other sources. And so you would tell us all these things about when it was built and for what purpose and so on. And of course, there's no request here for us to do anything to rebuild the tunnel or whatever, if we can read it. And once again, you wouldn't expect the future generations to be so much interested in technical details.
Right.
So, I mean, it's interesting to compare it to this kind of inscriptions that are in fact hidden from view, but it's still very, very much different from them. And if you apply these rules of discourse analysis to try to indicate to find out who the addressee was, it doesn't look it was either a god or a future generation.
Right. Well, great. I'm going to leave a link to your article, The Siloam Tunnel Inscription for the Living or the Dead. I think it's behind a paywall, but there are some ways to access it, perhaps. This was from Biblical Archaeology Review. And then you said you are working on a paper that'll be out sometime in the future. And when it does, we'll be able to hopefully reference that on our website, armstronginstitute.org, so that people can go through this themselves and put it together. in the way that you've been able to briefly describe. Is there anything else you want to discuss? If not, thank you so much for your time.
No, of course, I will let you know once the paper is published. And no, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity. And like you said, this is something that is different from a lot of approaches. And I was very happy when I got responses. Like I said, I talked to these people at the conference and elsewhere. So people who have comments, questions, I'll be really delighted.
Yeah, if there's a way that you are contactable, I don't know if you'd want to put that in, but people might have feedback to you for you. I can always forward that along or after the show if you desire, I can put some of that information in the show notes as well.
I'll be very happy. Please do.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Ariel Cohen.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much for watching, and thanks very much to Professor Cohen for the interview. If you like what you saw today, don't forget to like and subscribe to our channel and also request our free Biblical Archaeology magazine, Let the Stone Speak. Simply go to our website, armstronginstitute.org. And you can find a place on the front page to request your subscription, or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org. Don't forget to put some feedback in there as well. I just spoke again to Professor Cohen. He said if you'd like to send him some personal feedback regarding his ideas, you can address that to our email address, letters@armstronginstitute.org. I'll receive that and then forward it along to him. Thanks very much for watching.